All right, welcome to class. How are things? Everybody happy with WebGL? Before we dive into our topic about non-fluid physics today, anything you want to talk about? Yeah.
I was just wondering, is the WebGL submission supposed to give any like feedback?
Nope.
Okay.
There's no automated testing. I will download your file, find out what it was named, change your imports to be something I can use, and then look at it. It's a lot slower for me to grade, but that's okay. Other questions? Yeah? Do I what? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what those words mean.
Will you run this as a web server and then look?
No. I will run it localhost.
Right. But if you will you serve it from like some web server?
No, I will run it localhost.
Like are you loading it from like file URL?
Yeah.
And not like a local
host? No, I'm not running it on Apache, no. Because that theoretically means I would have to check your code for vulnerabilities we were trying to snoop my server. Not that I expect most of you will, but I've been here long enough to know there are people that do. And I don't want to spend that time. So I'll run it with file URLs and all of the cross-origin script blocks and so on that automatically enables. Anything else? All right, let me just say a little bit about the project. Look at that, 3 weeks, half of one of which is not class, before that happens. If you're thinking you're doing something other than the image manipulation project, I should know that soon. We don't need to be super formal about that. Drop me an email, come talk to me, something. But if I don't know what it is you think you're going to do, then we do not yet have a contract that'll be worth any points. It may still. Right, but the sooner we have that conversation, the better. I think I've had one person give me a hand-wavy, here's a big idea I have. And maybe all of you are planning to do images. That's fine. Right? But if you're thinking about doing something else, come talk to me, send me an email, post a private post at Piazza, in some way get my attention with what you're thinking of doing so we can try to scope that down for you. Yeah. All right. So today we're going to talk about non-fluid physics. And this means I have to remind you how kinematics works, because, you know, you all took Physics 1 so long ago that I don't necessarily expect you to remember it. So let's just talk about what we need to understand. There's arguably large numbers of non-fluid physicses, but in graphics we basically deal with two kinds of things, mass grain systems and rigid body systems, and we'll talk about what they're used for and so on. Sort of get our way up there. But first, let's just remind ourselves. If we have an essentially one-dimensional thing, has state, and it has, I don't want to call it state. Let's call it, it has some static, and it has some dynamic properties. Okay? The static property that does not change over the course of our simulation of a point is mass. The dynamic property of a point is position. Okay? But we usually don't want to think about a position because there's this nice thing called momentum, so we usually also want to think about its velocity. These two together are the state of a moving object. Because momentum is conserved, if we know the velocity, it will change the position, but it will also itself be conserved, so we want to know velocity. Okay? So this is the state of a point. And you learned probably long before you took physics as a course back in grade school, you probably started learning at least a little bit of the rules of physics, or maybe learned it later, that's fine. But there is this nice function, F equals ma, that you may have encountered before. Okay? So this relates this notion of force to acceleration using mass, which is something we know about things. And acceleration, of course, is the same thing as the derivative of velocity. However you want to do that. I don't care how you write your derivative of velocity. They're all good by me. Okay, however you want to write your derivative of velocity, they're all the same thing. How velocity changes. And so if we have a force, it changes the acceleration. Other things we should note about the types of these things, because they will matter in some of these. We have a scalar, i.e. a number, and both of these are vectors. Okay. Technically, one is a vector in the traditional sense. Velocity is a vector in the direction of magnitude sense. Position is a vector in the you can represent a point as a vector sense. But that's what we've got in this sort of point space. When we extend that to a plane, and here this is really, these really aren't quite in line, but if we have an arbitrary thing in a two-dimensional space, we still have all of what we had before. So we still have our static and our dynamic, okay? And we still have mass, we still have position, we still have velocity. But we have other things we need to understand. We have a center of mass. There is some point that is the thing that if it's just floating free, it will spin around. The center of its mass. It's the point you can balance it, and so on. So we have a center of mass. That's a characteristic of the geometry of the object. It also has a shape, or an outline, or structure, however you want to think about that. That's a property of the object. In the dynamic space, we have how it is spinning. Okay? We have its angular velocity. Okay. Its angular velocity is a new thing that's there, and with the angular velocity, we actually have a new thing like mass. We have, in addition to its mass, we have what we call its moment of inertia. You know, I've wondered ever since I took physics, and I've never looked it up. Does anybody know why it's called moment? Guessing it's related to momentum in some shortened version, but I haven't actually looked it up. Anyway, word I don't know about. All right, so the moment of inertia suggests like how resistant is it to changing its spin. Just like mass is how resistant is it to changing its velocity. Okay, and so in a plane, here we are in a 2D space. It's easier to talk about and draw things here, so we're going to do that a fair amount as we go along, but we'll compare it to 3D in a bit here. In a 2D thing, its angular velocity is a scalar. It's just how quickly is it spinning. It's just a number, okay? And so is its moment of inertia. Also just, I should be consistent about my use of color, shouldn't I? Also just a scalar, okay? Its shape, we've talked a little about how we represent shapes, lots of different ways of representing shapes, and its center of mass is some point. Its center of mass is usually what we think of as its position, okay? So we usually give the position of the center of mass, and then the shape gives me all of the other positions around it based on that. So we could argue that center of mass is really just a characteristic of shape. We can look at it different ways. Okay, we still have F equals ma, but we have a new formula we have to understand to deal with this, because we have to have this notion of torque. Torque is the angular, the rotational version of force, okay? And so we have this notion of torque, this notion of how much is a force trying to make it spin more or less. If we think of force as a vector, okay, we can take the cross product with something called R to get our torque. Okay, this is a 2D cross product. The same thing will work in 3D, but anyway. So cross product in 2D gives us a scalar. But what is R? R is the offset vector from the center of mass to some particular position. Okay, so if I have some position the force is applying to, it has an R, which is the offset of it from the center of mass of the object. And then the force also comes in at some vector. Okay, So the force applies on that point at some vector. And if I take the cross product of that, I will get how much of that force is the spinny force. And then the whatever's left is the linear force, the force we're usually used to thinking about. And so any force that applies at any point in the object, we can use a cross product to split into two different pieces and use that to deal with how this changes its spin and how it changes its motion using different momenta. Yes?
I don't think this is important for CS, but I think it is more cross that, the cross product
stuff. Oh, yes, I think you're probably right. That changes the sign.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, for graphics, if you consistently use the wrong sign everywhere, you never knew. But we should probably do it like physicists do. All right. So, we have torque and other angular stuff. When we get to 3D, all of this stays, but some of it, poof, becomes complicated values. Okay? We have, in addition to all of the static stuff and dynamic stuff we had before, some of these are going to have new values, so I'm only going to mention things that have changed. Our angular velocity is no longer a scalar. So our angular velocity is now a vector. But what does that mean? What we really mean is it has an axis and a magnitude. You're spinning around some axis. So if this is our center of mass, we might be spinning around this axis. And so that means that we're spinning in that direction. We could spin around any axis we want. And then we also have how fast are we spinning. And since the axis is a direction and magnitude is a scalar, we can combine them into a vector and frequently do. Right? And so a longer vector means you're spinning faster. A vector around a different orientation means you're spinning around a different axis. Okay? That also means that our I missed something dynamic over here. Orientation. Right? If you're spinning, what is changing? Your orientation is changing. Orientation over here was a scalar. Right? It's just a degrees or radians or however you like to do that. Okay? But over here in the dynamic space, our orientation is, it turns out there are lots of ways of representing the orientation of a three-dimensional solid. And part of the reason we have a lot of different ways is because this really belongs to an algebraic group we don't teach people early in life. And so none of the ways are beautiful. But the best way typically for graphics is we usually do this as a quaternion. Conceptually, a quaternion is also the same kind of axis magnitude vector from some sort of base position. So instead of how this is changing over time, it's just how much it's changed overall. The quaternion math gives us a little bit of extra freedom to combine it. We could have represented this with a rotation matrix. We could have represented it with an axis and angle, which is similar to what we have here. We could have represented it with how much we spun around x and y and z axis, although that gets something called gimbal lock, so we almost never do that. We have some kind of orientation. It's a little bit more complicated. Okay. We also, our moment of inertia changes its form. Okay. The moment of inertia needs to be able to take a force and around some axis, right? We need to be able to take some torque in particular and scale it. But in general, shapes might have more resistance to spinning around one axis than another. For example, it is easier to spin my umbrella this way than it is to spin it this way. Because the mass is farther away from the center when I do it lengthwise, so it has more inertia to spin this way than it does to spin this way. Although as it spreads out, it gets more inertia in that way too. Anyway, so we have this idea that our inertia varies by axis. And so the way we represent this, this becomes a matrix. We have a matrix that if you multiply a torque by it, you'll get another another vector out that tells us sort of the change in orientation that results. And so we can have more rotational inertia around some axes than others. The matrix characteristic limits the total set of function spaces to ones that are physiologically possible on a rigid body. And so these are the basic things we have to deal with when we're thinking about moving stuff around and trying to simulate some sort of physics on them. This is the basics of physics of things that don't squish. Questions about this review of I don't know how many years ago? All right. So we're going to talk about two basic families of solution approaches, mostly. But we're going to start by talking about one that's simpler than both, but a useful exercise in understanding what's going on. So we're going to talk about billiard balls. That is to say, round objects that bump into each other. Okay, billiard balls are a nice sort of initial position step here. A billiard ball we represent as being essentially just a point. We don't generally model, we could, and if we really want to make a billiard simulation, you will need to model how they spin around and so on. But a simple version, we can just pretend like they don't spin, they just bump into things, they have no friction with the ground, they'll just collide and bump. So we have a point, and we're going to give it a radius. Okay? And then we have all the things that points normally have, a mass, and a position, and a velocity, right? Which we had here. Position and velocity are the variable things. Mass is the constant thing, and because we want to make it a little bit bigger, we also give it a radius. And so this is the information we need to store. And if we ignore friction, which we will for the moment, this is very simple. They just move. They just move at their velocity. You can just multiply the velocity by how much time passed, add it to their position, and ta-da, you get the new position. The velocity never changes, that happens to the position. And this is a simple way of doing things until they hit something else. Okay? So we have our two balls moving along through space, and eventually they're going to bump into each other. And we need to figure out what they do when they bump into each other. So this actually is going to give us several concepts we're going to need for all kinds of different physics simulations. Okay? We're going to need to first detect the collision. We need to know they touched. Once we detect the collision, we're going to need to resolve the collision. We're going to change their state so that they don't overlap. Okay, because we don't like things to overlap. How do you detect their collision? What is a simple way of detecting collisions of round objects? The distance between the centers. If it is less than the sum of the radii, they overlap. Okay. So let's suppose I have two time frames. Okay, so we're going to have time one and time two. At time one, oh, let's use colors. Okay, so I have a ball here and a ball here. And at time two, I have a ball here and a ball here. So I can say, oh, they overlap, but I don't yet know where they collided. So how do I know where they collided? I want to know what time, they didn't touch at time two, that isn't when I should change their state, because they've passed through each other by time two. Okay, so I could just guess another time and see if they overlap until I find that magic time they start overlapping, yes?
You could just create two lines from their start point to their end point and then see where that line intersects.
Yeah, if I imagine time as space, then I can create these lines. Is this the time when they intersected?
It's when their centers
intersected. I want their centers to be the right distance apart. Okay? If they're moving linearly, this is a linear equation. Okay? If they're moving linearly in one dimension. Okay. In general, though, what I want to know is I want to solve for the time when their distance is some constant. Okay. So I want to say, okay, one of them has some initial position plus time times some velocity. And the other one also has that. Okay. And I want to know, you know what, I'm not going to use O for both of them because that's going to be annoying to talk about. Okay, let's use ones for, no, that's, we've used ones above. Let's use A and B. How about that? We'll call this ball B because it's the red ball. I didn't pick this well. All right. All right. So we have these two equations of motion, and what we want to know is at what time do they touch? Okay. So we want to find out when the distance between them, so xA minus xB plus tVA minus tVB, the length of that thing, we want to be equal to the radius of one plus the radius of the other. Okay? This, the length of a vector, is the square root of a quadratic function. But we can square this side, just make it a quadratic function, and we can solve it with the quadratic formula. So there's a closed form solution. We can just solve at the expense of a square root and a division for the time they touch. And if that's in the future, then we're good. If it's in the past, we're good. But if it's somewhere between time one and time two, then we need to do something at that time. Okay? You might already, maybe not, be thinking about, if these things weren't circles, how much more complicated this would be. Okay? Part of the reason we talk about balls is because they're easier to talk about. And all of this is going to get messy and need to be approximated. There was another solution suggested, though. And another solution that will work at sort of arbitrary time. If I decide they have crossed paths, I can use binary search. I can check the time halfway in between and see if they've touched then. And if they have, I can say, oh good, let's go back farther, and then I can start zooming in and keep chopping it in half until I get a narrow enough time window. I say that's good enough, they touched here. Okay. So there's various approaches I can use. If I am checking for collisions rather than by solving the quadratic formula, just by checking to see if they overlap at some time, we'll make sure my time steps are small enough they couldn't pass through each other. Okay? And so it's important if you're just looking at discrete times that you pick a small enough time step. In particular, if we have a bunch of balls moving around, we want our time step to be such that the fastest moving ball moves less than the radius of the smallest ball. And there's names for different criteria, but that will guarantee that they won't pass to the far side of each other. They'll figure out the approximately right side they bumped into. Anyway, there are other rules we can use to figure this out to cap our upper limit on our simulation time step. Or we can just solve this quadratic formula for every pair of balls and find the pair that would intersect first and go to that time and then go to the next time and so on. A problem with all of these versions, though, is they are quadratic in the number of balls. And we don't like that because it turns out we almost never want to simulate balls by themselves. We usually want to simulate thousands of them pretending like they're something more complicated. And so things that are quadratic or anything worse than linear in the number of them that exist is problematic. So very often what we will do is we will say, okay, there's a whole lot of these things. But we're just going to superimpose some sort of bounding hierarchy. Okay? Often we'll just use a fixed grid here rather than something hierarchical. Although we could do something hierarchical. And we will figure out for every point what grid cell are you in, one linear pass. And there's a second linear pass. We'll say every point check only enough grid cells away that it could possibly have bumped into something. Those will generally also be constant, and so we'll have a second linear pass. And so in two passes, both of time big O n, we can find all of the collisions between the balls as long as our time step was small enough. Detecting collisions. Thoughts, comments, questions about detecting collisions for balls bouncing around? All right, resolving collisions. Let's start with purely elastic collisions. A purely elastic collision has the property that no energy is lost and no momentum is lost. So let's just remind yourself of the definition of momentum is mass times velocity, and the definition of energy is 1/2 mass times velocity squared. Okay, we want to conserve these things. Much of what we're going to deal with is we're trying to simulate physics, at least at a visual level, is we're going to have some constraints. We're going to have some rules that these things need to be conserved. So before and after, these have to be the same. In particular, what do we mean? We mean that the mass of ball A before times the velocity of ball A before plus the mass of ball B before times the velocity of ball B before, that's the total momentum of the system. That needs to be the same as the mass of ball A after times the velocity of ball A after plus the mass of ball B after times the velocity of ball B after. That conserves momentum. Momentum is always conserved, barring matter turning into energy. Unless there is, they bumped into each other and pieces of it shattered and flew away, or they bumped into each other and this proton happened to get so close to that other one that they just poof turned into ultraviolet light or something, right? We're going to have momentum conserved. And it turns out there's one very easy solution to this, which is the velocities didn't change. That one's not a good one because it makes them overlap. Okay? However, this constraint right here, how many degrees of freedom did we lose? So degrees of freedom are something we often talk about in these simulations. How many degrees of freedom, how many values in the dynamic variables are there? So in the dynamic variables that we're possibly changing, we're not changing the position when things collide. Okay, so we had 3 degrees of freedom in each, or if we're in 3 dimensions, we had dimension degrees of freedom. I'm drawing 2 dimensions, so let's just say we have 2 degrees of freedom. I had 2 degrees of freedom in each ball's velocity. So I had 4 degrees of freedom in a planar ball collision. This equation, how many degrees of freedom does it remove? If these are 2 vectors. I have an x and a y coordinate on each side of the equal sign. So I removed 2 of the 4 degrees of freedom. Okay? If I can get down to 0 degrees of freedom, I have the answer. If I can't get down to 0 degrees of freedom, then I don't have the answer, I just have a family of okay answers. And I have to pick one from them. We're going to get both of those a lot when we're dealing with physics simulations in computers. Okay? Computer graphics. So we have this equation. We have something similar for energy. Okay? So energy, we're actually, because we're squaring, that's dotting the vector by itself. This is always a scalar quantity. And so this actually only removes 1 degree of freedom, but you can also pose it in a different way to get another one, right? You can get this, so it removes all the degrees of freedom, but not quite. Energy is defined as being linear, as just a scalar value. And so we technically, the equation here only has one equation, and so we still got 1 whole degree of freedom. And in physics, they can talk about where does that remaining degree of freedom go and how do we get rid of it by conserving other things, right? Don't need to deal with that particularly today. There is a solution. Physics has solved this many times over. You probably all had to solve this at some point in your physics classes. We can dig up the solutions here. Okay. It turns out that the solution for a perfectly elastic collision is very easy. Each one gets an addition to its, this is 1 degree of freedom, okay? This is 2 degrees of freedom. Let me go ahead and talk about where the third one is. The third one is the axis around which they hit. So when we have two things collide, I was going to hand wave it and then I realized, no, this is important. All right. When two things collide, we care about the axis on which they hit. The energy transfer can only happen along that axis. So whatever we do can only happen along that one axis. And so that removes another 1 degree of freedom, getting us down to the 0 degrees of freedom we need to get a unique solution. Okay? So move one to conserve energy, two because of momentum, one more because they collide around a particular axis, and then we're good to go. There are two unique solutions to this because there's a quadratic term with a plus or minus when we solve it, and away we go. We can solve for elastic collisions. If they're inelastic collisions, instead of before and after energy being conserved, after energy is a known amount less than before energy, where the amount less is how inelastic the collision was. But that still gives us an equation. We can still solve it and figure out where they end up going. Yes?
Can you repeat what happens in elastic collision?
Which part? The whole thing?
No, like...
Or this last constraint I put down here?
The last constraint.
The last constraint is I can only change the component of velocity that is aligned with their collision point. Okay? So because they collide at one point, energy can only transfer from that point through the centers of mass. Right? And so that constrains me from solving this equation. There are solutions. There's a linear amount from all angles we could have hit. So we could have two balls coming in from the side and preserve the laws of energy by having them bounce in right angles from where they started. Okay? But that violates this collision axis constraint, which helps us finish resolving what can happen. If they weren't balls and could collide at two points at once, we've lost this constraint and suddenly we have freedom to decide what happens. And freedom, right? For some definition of freedom. At some very high level, this is why we think of dice being random. Yes, they are deterministic, but we have these planes and we can't readily predict exactly which corner is going to hit first. One will, but we don't know which one it will be, and so it feels random where they bounce next. And that happens over and over again. Many things that seem slightly random create we can't predict, and we use them as a way of doing randomness. All right, so this is the basic idea of how we would do a billiard ball type of simulation. You have all these points floating around. We'd find collisions either by time stepping and slicing until we find the right point, or by solving the equations directly, or maybe just fudging, saying they overlap a little, but we'll pretend they'll touch. We'll just hope it works, right? We do that, and then we use these equations to figure out how their velocity changes. Typically, if we know this is all we have, we'll spend the time working through these equations and figuring out the nice, simple, closed-form vector solution of what happens. And for this one, there is a nice, simple, closed-form vector solution of what happens. Subtract a few things, multiply a few things, and poof, you don't actually need to handle the square roots and so on. But we also have the general equations we can use if we need to. All right, any questions about this? Okay. Billiard balls are nice. They don't have inertia. Inertia is a pain. There are things we do with billiard balls other than making them bump into each other. Which one shall we use? Let's use this one, because I think it has a pretty good picture if memory serves. Yeah, let's consider this picture here. We often simulate squishy things as mass spring systems. Meaning, we have little balls, just like the little balls we talked about, may or may not even bother having radiuses and things to collide, but usually we do. And then we pretend there were springs between them. Okay? Springs supply an extra force. In the conversation I've had here, you'll notice I have no forces. I've assumed that velocity just stays the same if you don't bump into anything. Okay? But spring forces are very easy. They're linear. If my distance is the right distance, I have no force. If I'm too far away, the farther I am from the rest distance, the more I'm pulled towards. If I'm too close, the farther I am away from the rest distance, the more I'm pushed. A nice, simple, linear function of distance. Sometimes, because distance is harder to compute than the square of distance, we'll make fake springs that have the square function instead of the linear function, and that's fine too. It still obeys all the laws of physics, even if they're hard to construct in reality. Okay? So we just create this system. Now, the nice thing about this is that it's flexible. If you pull on it, it will stretch. Right? It tries to get something like sort of rubber sheety kind of behavior. However, this particular set of springs has another rest configuration. Without overlapping, what other position could these points be in where all of the springs are the right length? I saw somebody do it with their hands. If I have these points, okay, and I want to have all of their springs between them, I can do the same thing. I'll leave these ones in a line, and I'll put these ones in a line the right distance away, and I'll put these ones in a line. You know what? I don't even have to do it for the same angle. Let's put these ones in a line. And it can all sort of skew around. Okay, it's a collapsible in one direction. Now, this is actually a characteristic of woven fabric. If you've done any fashion design, you know about hanging on the bias. I doubt many of you have. But anyway, this actually exists and matters, and there's different amounts of forces if it lines up with the warp and woof or if it doesn't. Because it turns out the computer graphics touches all fields, including clothing and weaving and so on. Anyway, but we don't want that in general. We can solve that basically because squares are unstable. That's the problem. Don't use squares. That makes the problem go away. Okay? So we could have arranged these points in, say, a triangular grid instead, and now there's only one rest position. Okay? We could have added these shear correction springs across the middle. That will allow us to have a different level of tension in the sheary direction than in the main direction, which will allow us to make things hang on the bias if we really cared about that kind of thing. Okay? Yeah?
Wouldn't just one of those diagonal ones be enough?
Yes, but it will be asymmetric. In two dimensions it would be fine. In three dimensions, it will start being asymmetric. It also tend to make some sort of non-local behavior. If I only connect these two and something pushes on that, I have this very indirect force around which will create artificial torsion that I wouldn't normally want. It'll correct out if we take small enough time steps, but for the short duration, it doesn't work very well. Okay? So we can combine these different pieces to try to make cloth. A simple thing that we often actually use mass spring systems for. When we do this, though, there's an extra kind of spring we very often want. And to understand the extra kind of spring, let's talk about rope or hair. Okay? Conceptually, rope or hair is nice because we don't have any width. But if these are the only springs we have, there is nothing that keeps it from just curling up into a tiny little ball. There's nothing that makes it want to be straight. And so we add to it some straightening springs that skip one. And ta-da, we have things that want to be straight. And we can tweak the strength of the direct springs that try to maintain length and the strength of these more distant springs that try to keep things straight. And by playing around with their relative impact, we can make things that want to curve more or less. Okay, and so we can tweak this around to make stiff or soft kinds of ropey things, and then we can do the same things in cloth, although it's harder to draw because we end up with springs all over the place. I should comment, just because it is not obvious from what I am saying, when we simulate this, we don't actually simulate the springs. They can pass through things, they can overlap with things, they don't have mass, we're not measuring the collisions of the springs. We could, We know how to intersect cylinders with things. It's more complicated than spheres, but we know how to do it. But we usually don't want to because they're just artificial ways of saying things like to stick together. Okay? So, we have this idea. And when we put this idea together, if memory serves, this one has some pictures of what it actually looks like when you're done. Okay? So this is actually some notes about how you would go about doing it and gives all things about how spring constants work and shows different alignments of springs and so on. And then it has, here we made it do something, and we noticed it's all kind of stretchy because springs are stretchy. And so on. There's different ways of integrating it, and then how do you make it collide? A big issue with this is what we call self-collisions. Okay? So this is two versions of cloth. One where they collide with itself and one where it doesn't. This one doesn't. This one does. The colliding with itself is the same colliding we just talked about for the billiard balls. We need to figure out, do they bump into each other? But to make nice high-resolution cloth, we want a whole lot of balls. Okay, so we may have, I don't know, they may actually say somewhere what this one's resolution is. I doubt it, though. Nope, I don't see it listed anywhere. But just glancing at it, to get this level of detail, right, if we have uniformly positioned balls, we probably have several hundred on each axis. Meaning we may have 10,000, 100,000 balls to represent the cloth as a whole. And so checking if all of those bump into all of the others is at least linear with a good grid system and quadratic without it. And there's just a lot of extra time, a lot of time we don't want to run in general. And so it costs more to say you can't overlap with yourself, but it also makes things better in how they look in the end. And from time to time, there will be a paper published where somebody will have a new cool system of saving some work in the self-collision for cloth, or adding new dynamics where the self-collision has friction or so on. Also part of the problem we have if we do with balls is it makes the cloth fat. Okay? And so, right, if we think about these, they have these different resolutions, right? But even at this resolution, the points are farther apart than the thickness of cloth. And so if we represent the cloth just as a polygonal sheet like this, it will appear to bump into things before it touches them. It'll appear to like hover around things and make things look puffy because they aren't touching them perfectly. And this one actually goes through the process of, what if you treated them all as spheres and used marching cubes? This is the thing we're actually simulating, this like rubbery foam thing. Right? That's what this really does. And if we want to make it thin, we have to put so many points. Okay? So it's nice, it works, it's very easy to compute. It's very easy to handle in lots of ways, but it doesn't really give us what we wanted very well. And so this article goes through in some detail different approaches to this and how we work around them. But this is the basic problem that we face with these sorts of systems. Yes?
Yep. Stay stretched out. Mm-hmm. So do they, in general, like ignore that effect for cloth?
Yes. Most cloth has virtually no plasticity. Right? Like, if you take your shirt and stretch out the sleeve, it does sort of stay stretched out, but so little. It basically just springs back. And that's probably pretty good because there's sort of this continual force to stretch the neck out. And pretty soon all your clothing would fall off if we just applied this, right, recursively. All right. We don't have to stop. We can do rope. We can do cloth. We can apply this in 3D as well. Okay, we have a bunch of points that are all attached to each other as springs in 3D. And at some point, this is how people tried to do things like flappy jowls and jiggly fat and so on creatures. And then they realized, it turns out that anything that's volumetric and springy, except for like a couple kinds of sponges, almost anything like that also conserves volume. And so more commonly these days, if we have a three-dimensional set of springs, we also do a fluid simulation. And so we'll typically simulate it as some sort of elastoviscous system. We'll use the fluid simulation to deal with volume, and we use the springs to keep things from just slopping all over the ground. And the example we saw 2 weeks ago now, I guess, of the bunny that melted in and then sprung back together is an example of this. When the bunny springs back together, they turn on the springs. And they deal with all of the collision detection is all solved by incompressibility and keeping things from being too dense. And we just get all the behavior we want out of combination of fluid and springs. So that's far more common today. Although sometimes if you don't have the energy to do a fluid simulation and solve a linear system, every single frame of every single object, you have just a little bit of jiggle in a game, for example, you might try some mass spring to do that even for volumetric stuff. As sort of a rough approximation, even though it will be compressible. And if you want something that compresses, like a mattress or a sponge or something, then mass springs works pretty well. One other thing to say about mass springs, and then we'll move on to rigid bodies. Okay, let's suppose I have my mass spring rope. Pretend like these were uniformly spaced. Sorry, I wasn't very good at doing that. And then I'm going to take one of these and just tug it really far away. What is the minimum number of time steps before the end of the rope moves?
Number of links in the rope.
Number of links in the rope. This is a problem. This means the higher resolution my rope is, the slower it reacts, right? So if I have a, so this is quite bad. If you imagine, right, they have this picture of like, okay, low res and high res cloth, okay? I will start, my animator will start using a low res cloth to make sure it looks approximately right, but then when they render, they're gonna want the high res cloth. And if suddenly they add resolution and then their clothing is like lagging behind their character as they walk along, not a great solution, okay? So in practice, although mass springs I've talked about, we could just do the pair springs, in reality, these aren't local behaviors either. Just like water where you push on one side and the other side comes out of the hose, you pull on one side of a rope, the other side moves. And so in practice, for higher resolution, for higher quality stuff, we're going to create a linearization of all of the spring functions and solve a linear system of equations to figure out how all of the masses move in a single time step. Yes?
I was a little confused as to the premise of the whole thing, like why it takes
one. Okay. Let's suppose I fix this in place and there's no gravity and the rest of this is at rest. How many of these masses have a spring force pulling on them in the first frame? So the first frame will move this one in closer. The second frame, now this one is stretched, and so it will move in closer. The third frame, now this one is stretched, and so it will move in closer.
Okay, so you've arbitrarily decided to say that you can only like move one per frame. Like what you're now saying is you can do the whole thing.
Right. Now, if I solve in a particular simulation order, if I know it's a rope, and I say, okay, this is the most stretched out spring, let's solve it first and work to the less stretched spring later, it'll be better. But it won't be anywhere near as good as we would hope. Okay, let's see if I can make a clearer version of why that is. Let's suppose I solve this one first. This point wants to be halfway between these two to minimize the spring forces. So this point wants to move over to there. This point wants to be halfway between these two. So it wants to move over to there. This one wants to be halfway between these two. So it moves over to there, and that one over to there, and that one over there, and that one over there, and that one hardly moves. So even if in a single time step I move them all in the optimal order to get the end of the rope to move, it still barely moves. And it doesn't really matter how strong I make my springs, I can make that spring constant up the wazoo, I still won't see the end of this rope moving suddenly. If I just do one pass over each of the masses on each frame. So I might see nothing moves until many frames later. If I do one order, I might see it sort of stretches out and lags after, but no matter how I do it, if I do just one sort of localized control, it will always have this localized phenomena. So the solution is, you take, the solution is the same as the solution to water. Okay, you take all of the equations of motion, okay, which here is a version of it, the net force that acts on things, all of these forces, okay, and you figure out what these forces are and you linearize them in the current time, you get a linear system of equations. And you solve the linear system of equations and then for some particular time step and apply that. And then you do it again. Right? Linear systems of the equations are the way we do this. Now, it turns out for some mass springs, even linear is a problem. And so this page actually talks about the explicit, which doesn't work very well. That's the one we just sort of drew out on the board. But we can also use the Runge-Kutta. And so we don't even have to do it linear, right? And then there's Wirtlet and Euler. And anyway, there's lots of different integration techniques. Because what we're really trying to do is spread this force down the line sort of simultaneously. And so there's lots of approaches to doing this, lots of different integrators that work. And there's difference between implicit and explicit and semi-implicit. And anyway, and if you, this is not a numerical analysis class, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on how we do all of this. But there's pretty good papers in this space describing how they work. This even has like specific conversations about how it is that you run the Euler's method and so on to make them all work. Does this answer your question? All right. Other questions? All right. Mass spring systems. Let's come back to here. All right. Now we're going to talk about big blocks of things with shape. Okay. How do we make blocky things with shape behave? Let's take, as a starter, the square ball version of billiard balls. Okay? If square bumps into square, what happens? We still have to detect collisions. Detecting collisions is harder. Note these two squares do not intersect. Hopefully this is not a surprise. However, they overlap in X and they overlap in Y. Right? This is just the first step of saying it's hard to notice if things collide. There are various methods that will take advantage of characteristics of the shape. So if the shape is convex, if it has no divots or holes, we can use what's called the method of separating axes, which is sort of like the simplex method in linear programming. I know what the simplex method in linear programming is. Okay, not very many of you. All right. The basic idea of separating axes is we look at one face at a time and figure out, does this face look like it has an intersection? This face does not look like it has an intersection, so we move on to the next face. This face does look like it has an intersection, so then we're going to go to this object and do the same thing. And you sort of walk between the two until you find the face that is proof there is no intersection. The face that all of the vertices of the other object are on the outside of. And there's a few little steps to do this, but you just sort of walk around, sort of a staggered, take a few steps around one, take a few steps around the other, until you find one or the other of them says, that object's outside. In 3D, this is more complicated. The method of separating planes needs extra decisions about which neighboring face to go to next, but can be solved with relative ease and a lot of code. It's fast code, it's linear code, but it's a little bit messy. But that only works if it's convex. Okay? If we have concavities, things become much harder. Okay? Those two objects don't intersect, but how do I know? I can't use that. There's no magical line or face that says everything's on the far side of it. Right? I don't have any shortcut. Okay, and so in general, you have to check if all of the edges of one object fail to intersect any of the facets of the other. It's messy. And so just detecting the intersection of objects can require significant work in the complexity of the geometry of the object. So we detect the collisions. Once we detect the collisions, we discover, they touched right there. our equations of motion do more things. Okay? They collided right here. The energy that is distributed between the two as part of that collision is going to, right, whatever force is applied there, let's suppose we decide that is, it's going to apply a force that's perpendicular to the area of collision. So we're going to have a force here, any force here. On this object, that's purely translational, because it goes directly to the center of mass. On this object, it's both translational and torsional. It's going to make it spin faster or slower. It's going to make it spin to the right as I've drawn it, or spin clockwise when they collide, and it's going to make it move. And so we do some cross products to figure out how much each of them applies, and this makes it messier. And so it's quite possible that these could hit so hard that this starts spinning really fast, and then this side bumps into that point, and right, we could have multiple collision events in a single interaction. Okay, we can solve all of those pieces, but it's a little bit complicated. And often we aren't just interested in boxes bumping into each other. Often we are interested in, let's take the nunchuck example. We have two rigid bodies that share a point, the simplest version of a nunchuck. Okay? We should really have a chain there and so on. But, you know, if we just imagine they just have a point that they have to share, then now I have a constraint. Okay? I have this extra rule that's going into what's happening. I have the constraint that says they can't have different positions here. However, I can come back and think of all of these as being constraints. I have the they don't cross paths constraint. Okay? And so each of these constraints, the they don't cross paths constraint, the energy can only transfer in one direction constraint, they share this point constraint, the energy can only flow through that point constraint, each of these constraints limits the degrees of freedom of the system. And so in general, when we're dealing with rigid body dynamics, what we have is an optimization problem. We want to minimize the change in energy or something like this, the error, how much action is happening, because the universe is basically lazy. So I'm going to minimize how much energy is changing subject to various constraints. There might be they can't pass through each other constraints. There might be they have to share this point constraints. We have a lot of constraints. Okay? And then we have a minimization problem. In general, this is what we call a non-convex optimization problem. Okay? So this is like linear programming, but so much worse. So let's just look at one. The Open Dynamics Engine is one example library that tries to do this. And so it describes, okay, your rigid body has linear position and linear velocity and orientation, angular velocity and mass, a position of the center of mass, and index of inertia. We talked about all of those things, okay? They have some pictures to try to show you what they're talking about in case you haven't seen it before. They have types of joints. And for each one of these types of joints, a ball socket, a hinge, and I don't remember what they call that one, a piston probably? A piston or slider joint, right? These constrain the motion of these two objects in some particular way. Okay? And then they have things called joint groups to make things more efficient, and they have what do you do? Is it okay if the ball socket gets a little bit out of link as long as it's close, or is it not? If you're allowed a little bit of fuzz, it becomes easier to solve the math. If you need it to be exact, it's harder. And then they have all different kinds of integrators. Okay. So are we accumulating force? How are we applying the joints? How does this work? Do we just move everything and then force them all to obey the constraints, and then some of the constraints are violated by others and do it again and again and again and again and again? Or what? How is the approach we use? And they have different ones in this engine. There is so much to know about this. So much to know. I toyed for a moment with just walking through these slides. And then I thought, I'm just not a slides person. I don't know. But this goes all through all of this stuff. okay? And talks about how you find times of collision and what happens when you find a collision and collision constraints, and actually has full formulas that I didn't want to derive in the moment about how you find the relative normal of velocity and the collision response. And then you look at this, right? After manipulating some equations, poof! Right? You're like, this is still just two things bumped into each other. Right? Hasn't even got to the interesting part yet. And that's near the end of this slide deck. There are more slide decks. Anyway, all kinds of symbols and so on. And if you really want to play in this space, you need to understand those sorts of things. In general, rigid body dynamics goes through a lot of extra hoops to solve one particular really hard and really common problem: stacking. Stacking is the bane of every rigid body simulator out there. Okay, let's explain why. I have the ground. I have a box. I have another box on the box. And another box on that box. And another box on that box. And another box on that box. And ta-da, I have created the action at a distance, the non-local phenomena that makes everything hard. Okay? Because this box only stays up because of the ground and is not directly connected to the ground. And so if I have any kind of, these two objects are colliding, let's have them average their velocities in some way, or the velocity of this one transfers into this one, so that one starts moving down, that makes it collide, that makes it collide, that makes it collide. Okay. And so getting things to stack is hard. Common fast solutions, common local solutions, you will see compression. What they'll generally do is they'll just say, we'll let things overlap, and then we'll try to apply some force to correct the overlap. And then we'll show you what you saw, and we'll do it again. And what that will usually cause is we will see this bottom box will be shoved into the ground, and the next box will be shoved into that box, and the next box will be shoved into that box, and the next box, tiny bit of overlap, and then the end, everything will be fine, except the bottom one collapsed. Yes?
Is that why sometimes it seems like things bounce when you're stacking games?
Yeah, so you can say, okay, but if they get too close, we can overcorrect, we can push them back out. And that will correct it, right? They'll collapse, we'll push them away, but now they're not overlapping, so they're gonna collapse again, right? You find that magic overcorrection to try to make things look pretty good with minimal bouncing, not easy to do. Any localized solution will have some version of this problem. There are even, because this is such a common problem, there are specialized systems that will notice that some objects appear to be at rest and move them from the dynamic obstacle to the static obstacle pool and say, this box seems to basically be staying still. I'm now just going to lock it in place. It no longer moves. And then they have special rules about, but some new force applied to it, we have to kick it back into the dynamic space, right? But that's all breaks if the ground starts moving, or right, anyway. And to really solve this, you're going to need something worse in general than a linear system of equations. You're going to need a non-convex optimization problem, which in general, that space of problems is NP complete. As a matter of fact, rigid body dynamics is NP complete. We can demonstrate this by figuring out how to make a mechanical Turing machine and then building it out of blocks. Right? Straightforward approach. Okay? It's not, they're big and complicated, but solving rigid body dynamics is as hard as anything that exists. Now, common solutions are not that bad. And so there's a lot of effort in making things that work well for common sorts of things. For example, there is something we call ragdoll physics. Ragdoll physics was originally a pejorative, but it's sort of been adopted by the community. This refers to how we say, okay, we have some humanoid made out of rigid bodies. And we hook them together with links, and we let them flap around and bump into things. Okay? At various times, coming back into popularity will be some sort of online game that makes ragdolls fall into things or throws them around or whatever, right? People like watching this because they look vaguely humanoid and they wouldn't do this with real people. Anyway, there is a very nice structure of ragdoll physics that means that we can solve them exactly in linear time. And that is, they have a tree-like structure. Okay? They have this nice structure that we don't have any loops in the model itself. Now, if the arm and the leg hit the ground at the same time, that goes off. But because this matters enough for people, there is, nope, all right, there is this paper. I link to this paper in particular because it has good references, it is reasonably clear about how things work. Lagrange multipliers for the win, anyway. It goes through at some detail how you turn a rigid body dynamics problem into a graph problem where the graph is a tree, and find certain properties of the graph, and then use that to find the optimal order to resolve things in. Okay? And so they have, this is also a nice paper because they actually show you full matrices for many things. Okay? So if you really care about this space, this is a great starting point, because it'll actually walk you through how you make the matrices. Now, a lot of these, it turns out, are block matrices where each of these things represent matrices, but he shows you those matrices too. Okay? So you can actually go through and get the whole thing working from this one paper, which is an unusual thing. It's sort of an entry-level research paper, right? And about how you do all of this and how they can finally get this in linear order. There's a lot of math because it's physics, right? But it works out all the way through. There's also a reasonable explanation of other solutions. So unlike most people that in their related works, they basically say everybody else is not as good as us. This paper says there's a whole family of solutions that are way cooler than ours for many situations, but not our specialized situation. And here's why it's way cooler, and some good papers to read if you want to learn about it. Right? It's an excellent introductory paper. So if you're interested in how all of this works and how you use Lagrange multipliers and why you should care about all of those things you ignored in math, right? It's a great entry point to that. Thoughts, comments, questions? Okay. Let me try to summarize a bit. And try to give some thought about why we have these different approaches. I started by summarizing some physics. And there was a lot fewer things to think about if they were just points. A lot fewer things to think about is nice as a student because it makes it easier to do your homework. It's nice for a computer for the same reason. Right? If we can get rid of details, we have to write less code and the computer has to do less homework. And so we try to do as much as we can, as simply as we can, because it makes things efficient and easy to check. And because of that, mass spring systems are a beautiful solution if they will work. If we can get a localized only mass spring with a small number of masses to work well for us, it's going to be simple, easy to understand code with predictable behavior without any weird special cases, and we love it. But we can't, because we need high resolution and we get lag, or because we need volume preserving, so we have to do all that stuff we did the last couple of weeks with fluids, okay? And so we stop being able to do it the ideal way. Similarly, with rigid bodies, if we can make things convex, we can figure out what things bump into other things. We'll try to break the world into convex chunks. It'll make our lives easier. Okay? How do we actually detect collisions of these two objects? We pretend that each one of them was three objects. And I'm not joking. This is actually how you would solve this problem. Instead of trying to figure out if any edge presses any other thing, you would say, but really, that was these three objects, and that was these three objects, and each of those are convex. That has theoretically added a quadratic blow-up in collision detection time, but as long as I can make it a small number of convex things, things work. Question?
Don't you still get the problem when they're now stacked/touching?
So this is just collision detection. Okay, so I still have all the problems I would have for stacking and so on, but for detecting collisions, convex is easier. And so if I make things into convex, I do, right? But the real solution, too messy. If we can approximate it, we do, and we get that same, this is really a mass spring system written backwards, right? We have masses, and we treat spring forces to push them away only if they were overlapping, right? We're doing that same basic approach to try to push them apart, but it makes things squishy. And if we can get away with the squish, we do. And if we can't, things become complicated, and we start saying, well, is there other things we can take advantage of? Can we take advantage of particular structures of the constraints? Can we take advantage of knowledge about maximum speeds? Can we make the world very viscous so it just sort of like floats through the air? We don't really care, right? What can we do to make the world simpler? And if we can't do any of those, then we talk to the numeric analysis people and say, is there any reasonable way of solving our sparse systems? And sometimes they say yes, and sometimes they say no, and sometimes they're us. So, and that is my summary of non-fracturing physics. We still have 4 minutes. Anything else you would like to know? Yes?
What happens when we have three collisions at once?
Yeah, that's a really good question. What do you do when you have three things happening at one time? Actually, even two collisions at once is a little bit messy, right? Because typically, even if we just think about our non-convex optimization, we put each of the constraints as its own thing. And each of them is typically just a pair of things, right? And so really that is the other half of this problem, is we have many collisions, that we have two constraints on this cube. And when we try to solve them one at a time, we end up overlapping things. If we could solve them both at once, this wouldn't be a problem. But solving two collisions at once gives us so much more complicated math. And really, we'd have to solve all of them at once, and that's where it gets hard. So usually what we do is we treat them one at a time, and then trust to some sort of iterative process to do that several times until they all seem to work. And the paper that I just said nice things about, the basic idea here, let me go down to section, elimination order. They spend all of this work to talk about graph process to find the right order to do things in. And they finally find the right order, and then they say, okay, now we can go through in one pass and do all of our work, and it will all work out perfect, huzzah. Okay? Conceptually, for the stacking, that order is from the ground up. If I go from the ground up, stacking's not a problem. It's only if I go from the sky down that it's a problem. Okay? And there is a similar concept for anything that we can order, linearize, put into a tree. But if I can't do that, if I have a cycle, then I have to do something iterative instead. Other questions? Okay. Just as a random aside, compared to the complexity of collisions, things like special relativity are trivial. Okay? If you ever decide you want to make your game where the speed of light is 8 miles an hour, it'll be a little bit of work. But compared to the work you've already done to make things bounce into each other, it won't be that bad. Okay? And every once in a while, you'll find this paper that says, ooh, we just realized hyperbolic geometry is easy compared to everything else we're doing. We're going to make a hyperbolic geometry game engine, or whatever it is. Okay? The trick there usually is in helping the people developing the art know what it is you're talking about, right? So there is considerable work in sort of expanding the stuff that like, you know, having, you know, the special relativity version of conservation of momentum, not too bad. General relativity I haven't seen used yet. But I've seen special relativity, I've seen efforts to do some basic quantum, I've seen four-dimensional spaces, right? Once this math mostly didn't depend on any of those things. We're linearizing it anyway around some particular scenario to solve things. We can linearize any function, but if we can differentiate it, we can linearize any differentiable function, right? And so very often, if you decide to, there's this whole space that is almost untapped in the industry because it's really hard to market. And not many people start thinking about it. But the computational aspects of it, the hard part is the stuff that humans don't think about. Like, did I touch you? Duh, but not for a computer, right? And so this is just one of many examples of where the difficulty of communicating between the business people and the technical people sort of constrains what we end up doing in practice. And that's my little moment in soapbox, and we're out of time. I will see you all next week.